This is Matt Wells at UN News. Not only does torture not work, it's counterproductive, and when the practice elicits false confessions, societies pay a very heavy price. That's from Professor Juan Mendez, who served as the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture from 2014 to 16, and experienced torture himself while practicing law in his native Argentina, defending political prisoners during the country's 1970s military dictatorship. He spoke to UN News' Natalie Hutchison in New York on the sidelines of the General Assembly as part of a meeting outlining how member states are implementing a 2016 UN initiative to eliminate the practice.
Although torture has been prohibited for centuries, it was only in the 1980s that it was defined in the Convention Against Torture. And it's defined as pain and suffering deliberately inflicted by a state agent with the purpose of interrogation or obtaining confessions or punishing or any other purpose that involves discrimination. So the definition is relatively clear, and this Convention Against Torture has been ratified by more than 160 countries. This is one of the conventions that has the most adherents of all states, so there's no question that this definition is universal.
And since that definition was established in the 80s, how has the elimination of the practice evolved? Are we seeing improvements?
Well, no, we lag behind. We have progress and we have setbacks all the time in the last couple of decades because of the war on terrorism and the war on organized crime. Many states have at least relaxed their prohibition. They never agree that they have that they practice torture, but they use euphemisms like enhanced interrogation or and they claim that that's legitimate. Of course, it's not, and the very fact that they have to use euphemisms means that they know that torture is illegal. But I would say worse than that is the fact that also in the last couple of decades, we are fighting against a popular culture that conditions us to accept torture. Not that it's good, but it's more a sense of it's dirty, but somebody has to do it. It is possible to demonstrate with scientific evidence and experience that not only torture doesn't work, but it is actually very counterproductive. It obtains confessions, but confessions could be truthful or false. And when they elicit false confessions, not only do they create a grave injustice to a person who could be convicted of a crime that he or she didn't commit, but it also corrupts and undermines the whole criminal justice system, including several institutions that then, you know, lose the trust of the population. And the trust of the population is what makes police work and work well. When they lose the trust of the population, maybe they are feared, but they're not necessarily respected or trusted.
Right.
And I think in that sense, societies pay a very, very high price for engaging in torture.
And what are some of the non-coercive methods of interviewing that you presented today at the General Assembly in your report?
We haven't presented yet a document because we're still working on it. There are several states that have adopted a sort of a methodology of questioning, you know, suspects, but also witnesses and victims that is not based on confession. That is based first and foremost to look for the truth, what really happened. And if the interrogator goes into the meeting thinking that he already knows the truth, then very likely he's going to, you know, use violence to obtain a confession because that's a way of, quote unquote, solving the crime. Mm. But if the interrogator goes in with an open mind and willing to find out exactly what happened, including confirming some things that he already knows, but perhaps trying to find out things that he doesn't know, then the methodology is based on what is called rapport, you know, creating a relationship between the interviewer and the suspect or victim or witness that, you know, reduces tensions, reduces fear, and invites the person to collaborate, cooperate with the police. People do tell you what you need to know without brutality. And there's many different facets to it, like being prepared before time, being able to let the person give a first account and then ask questions later, you know, especially, as I said, building a rapport and keeping the rapport going until the case is presented to the courts.
And maybe if you could detail some of the questions that are asked or the way, the manner that the interviewer is asking them.
And well, the manner is obviously first and foremost respectful. Whoever is sitting against on the other side of the desk is a human being, has to be respected. Even if you think he committed a serious crime, you know, you still have to respect the dignity inherent in his being a human being. Second, it's a question of building rapport. And the first thing is not to interrupt, not to say, no, you're lying to me, you're really guilty of this crime, etc. But first, letting the subject give you the first account, a free account that is not extracted from him or her, but is an opportunity to make a voluntary statement. And then, and only at the end of the statement, questions may be given that are a way of confronting it with what the interviewer already knows from other evidence. Then, yes, there's always a possibility of saying the scientific evidence, for example, is different from what you're telling me. But again, in all cases, with respect for the human dignity of the person being interviewed.
And you mentioned that there's this idea that it's perhaps necessary. Some people believe that it has to be done. But in how many of these cases is it a matter of life and death?
People who defend torture have been using what's called the ticking bomb scenario forever. I mean, I've heard it when I was a law student, so you can imagine it comes back all the time. There's no sense in denying that people are very readily convinced. You know, the person in front of you knows where a bomb is about to explode, and you have to take that information from that person. But first of all, that's not the way torture happens around the world every day. On the contrary, and besides, quite frankly, somebody who placed a bomb is a hardened criminal, a hardened terrorist. It's not going to be, you know, easily dissuaded from hiding that information just because you torture them.
Could we get into a little bit about your personal experience?
Sure.
In your early career as a lawyer defending prisoners of war during Argentina's military dictatorship, would you mind sharing what your experience was with torture and how you overcame that?
First, I had a lot of experience because I defended political prisoners, and many of my clients were either tortured or I was trying to prevent them from being tortured, you know, like filing a habeas corpus petition immediately after arrest and all that. So I was very familiar with the way interrogations happened during the military dictatorship in Argentina. And then it happened to me. They arrested me, as they did arrest many lawyers in Argentina. I was one of 125 or so who either were detained for a while or are disappeared. And to me, they did the same thing that they did with any other suspect at that time, because they considered us part of the terrorist organization, even though all we did was defend people who they considered terrorists. They treated us exactly the same. In my case, they applied the electric prod to me in very intense sessions, so it was very, very painful. It was at a time when there were still some safeguards, and so they were in a hurry to get as much information from me as they could before a judge could intervene, for example. And my family worked very well in that direction. They obtained some ways of protecting me. So if anything, I was luckier than most, because my torture was very, very painful and intense, but it lasted only a couple of days or 3 days, I think, whereas the par for the course at that time was that they tortured you like for a week or so before torture stopped for one reason or the other. You know, I remained nevertheless in prison for a year and a half, although judges cleared me of any possible charges, because of the state of siege, as they call it, state of emergency or state of siege, by which the military could hold you indefinitely without trial and without even taking you to a court.
And in those moments, did you ever give in? Did you submit?
Well, fortunately, I don't have in my conscience the fact that I gave any information about friends or colleagues or people I knew, so that they would be tortured as well. I managed not to say anything that that led anybody else to be tortured. But that's not to say that I didn't falter from time to time, and especially when they told me that they were going to do the same that they were doing to me, to my little children, who were then 3 and 4 years old, you kind of break down. And, even after breaking down, I was able not to lead them to information that was useful to them. But yes, I did tell them that I was a lawyer representing political prisoners, and they wanted to know how I learned that somebody had just been arrested and things like that. And those details, I kind of managed to say things that didn't lead them anywhere.
Right. Thank you for sharing that and opening up, by the way.
No, by the way.
Finally, what do you believe the UN's role is in eliminating this issue?
The UN has been really great in creating a normative framework for the prohibition on torture that is now quite detailed and very systematic. And so it gives us many tools. For example, the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture establishes a series of visits and organizations, both domestic and international, that can help prevent torture before it happens. And in the same way, we have very good, very detailed norms about the treatment of prisoners that have been with us since the 1950s and from time to time are updated. We are working very well on mental kinds of torture like solitary confinement and things like that. But we're still always in the need for more detailed norms, standards. And in particular, in this case, that is, what happens right after detention and while the police is trying to find out what the person knows. Here, I think we have an opportunity to universalize the better practices that exist around the world. And these are practices that are the law and the practice in some states, but they're also universal in the sense that many policemen know that those would be the better way to do police work in their own countries, even if the country has not yet adopted a model of that sort. So my sense is that if we can, write up a series of guidelines and put them into a document that we would call a protocol or something like that, this is the better way of finding out crime and discovering it and obtaining evidence to go to trial. Then I think they will be, and if it has the imprimatur, obviously, of the United Nations, then I think it'll go a long way in modifying practices and particularly changing the culture of law enforcement in many countries that today practice torture.